One of the biggest intellectual property battles of the last decade took place between two doll makers, the company that invented Barbie and Bratz.
It started when a young designer became frustrated with his work at Mattel, the maker of Barbie. He took his new and non-traditional ideas to a rival company, MGA Entertainment, and helped launch Bratz. Here's what one of the early ads sounded like.
Getting ready for tonight. The girls are doing it right. Bratz. Salon and spa all day. To get the look.
No pink.
Your way.
Real makeup.
Bratz.
67 accessories.
Dana. Yasmin. Chloe. Sasha. Jade. The girls with a passion for fashion.
Bratz. See you tonight.
For a while there, Bratz unseated Barbie from her throne as the iconic doll of American girlhood. Suddenly, blue-eyed, blonde-haired Barbie was competing with a group of multi-ethnic dolls, and their style was urban, and they had exaggerated eyes and mouths and really large heads.
The battle was more than just a case of competition between two companies. It became a question of what example the different dolls were setting for girls. Were Bratz too edgy, too sexualized? Was Barbie too white, too out of touch with the times?
In her new book, Orly Lobel tells the story of the epic legal battle between the two doll makers and the public's reaction. She's a professor of law at the University of San Diego, and her book is called You Don't Own Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side. Orly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Orly, tell us, let's start this with the telling of Carter Bryant's story. Who was he and what role did he play?
Carter was a designer at Mattel. He had dreamt always to be in the fashion industry. He dreamt to be a designer. But really, in this industry, in the fashion industry and the doll industry, there was one big player in town in Los Angeles when he graduated. And his dream was not to color Barbie's dress every few months in a different color, and sort of he felt that it was tiring and stagnated, but he took that job with the hope that he will be able to pursue his creativity, to bring new ideas. But I think he became very frustrated with working in this large, very dominant organization.
And so, if I'm remembering from your book correctly, you know, he, as a child, was drawing these drawings of women. He found a lot of inspiration from the Archie comics. And then through into going to design school in Los Angeles, he wanted to, as you said, go into high fashion. You know, how did he really see the trajectory there from moving from Mattel into something else?
I think he was not very hopeful about being able to get into a different line of business. It was a hard market. He tried to advance at Mattel. He tried to go at it alone, trying different things, but he didn't see a lot of potential. It was just sort of a hard thing where becoming an entrepreneur, becoming an independent designer, whether it's fashion designer or starting a new line. He loved dolls. He loved drawing characters. He would draw cartoons and angel holiday cards, but he just sort of didn't find his way. So he was just doing a lot of creative stuff during weekends and nights, and while he was on leave, he took some leave to just rest and, I think, refined his passion.
So, you know, he had this this trajectory through Mattel, did some stuff on his own, came back to Mattel. Can you describe what it was like to, or what it might still be like to work at Mattel, at a company like Mattel?
Mattel is a huge company. It didn't used to be like that. Every company, you know, has a great start story. And actually, the book has a point where we go back to the future, back to the past, where we look at how this huge behemoth, rather stagnated and not very innovative company today that really dominates the toy industry, used to be also a startup and with a lot of creativity and a lot of passionate people that were the founders. But now, when Carter was working there, it really became a very bureaucratic, very kind of mundane place with a lot of politics, a lot of hierarchy, and a lot of sort of stop and go, stop with ideas that were left at the cutting board.
And, you know, what kind of agreements did someone like Carter Bryant have to sign while working at Mattel?
So that's a great question. And actually, one of the motivations of writing You Don't Own Me, the book, was that what Carter went through is something that is not unique to the toy industry. So in every single industry and every field of work, people are constantly and more asked to sign these very generic agreements, very vast, broad clauses that say that any idea that you have, any invention, any kind of creativity that you might want to apply in the future, the company now owns. So it's sort of a non-compete, proprietary information that all lists these very broad just language that says that really means that it's very, very difficult for employees to then leave their company.
So in Carter Bryant's case, he was still an employee technically at Mattel when he started working on, you know, what became the Bratz dolls. Can you talk about from, you know, creation to eventually selling Bratz to MGA, you know, how that came to be?
Right. So this is a 10-year litigation, and part of the meat of what the jury had to decide was when exactly did Carter come up with this idea. And I won't give any spoilers, but he had a whole story about how he was on leave. He left L.A., went to Missouri, stayed with his parents, and was really inspired by things that had nothing to do with his job at Mattel. But as you said, when he came back, he continued to work on it during weekends and nights, and eventually gave notice to Mattel, went to the competitor and said, develop this doll line.
And so how did we get to this 10-year legal battle? What happened?
So at first, really what happened was that for the first time for many decades, suddenly there was a competitor to this, you know, dominant doll that has affected all of us, you know, throughout the second half of the 20th century, Barbie. And, you know, we all have reactions to Barbie. We all have, I think, ideas about the good, the bad, whether we played with her, whether we as parents want our kids to play with her. At first, really, what was nice about the development of Bratz is that suddenly there was more choice, more consumer choice, more choices for kids and for parents to have, you know, different dolls for their kids to play with. But what happens later is that Mattel finds out that this huge competition that never happened before, because Mattel, as I describe in the book, is very litigious and has not been very happy about having any competition thus far, and it's been very difficult for new entry in that market. And when it finds out that Carter was behind this idea, it pulls out the contract from the past and it sues the competitor and says, we own this whole empire that you now developed.
So Carter Bryant, you know, he signed this agreement. Mattel pursues litigation. And, you know, you write in the book that, you know, Mattel has been extremely litigious. It actually loses a fair amount of money. You know, what does this do for Mattel in the long run?
That's a really good question. And it's, I think, something that is hard to assess in general with these companies that are the dominant actor in the market and that launch litigation even when they lose even when it's rather frivolous against anybody who challenges their product, their dominance, their intellectual property as they define it. They definitely, I think, see litigation as part of the business model, that if they want to control the image of Barbie, any artist that does a parody of her, any designer that wants to do something either competitive or something that's completely unrelated, like take some photographs and write an article, they need to control the message and get them to stop. And so they use their litigation arm, a big fleet of, you know, of lawyers to try to stop that.
We're talking to Orlie Lobel right now. She's a professor of law at the University of San Diego, and she's the author of the new book, You Don't Own Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you remember playing with these dolls, or do you have kids that still play with them? Were you a parent when Bratz came onto the market? What did you think at the time? Did you have a stake in this battle, Barbie or Bratz? Maybe neither. Tell us why at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're picking up the conversation with Orlie Lobel. She is a professor of law at the University of San Diego, and she's the author of the new book, You Don't Own Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were Barbie or Bratz dolls part of your childhood, your parenthood? Did you have strong opinions? Do you have strong opinions one way or the other on either of these lines of dolls? Tell us what you think they mean to you, to our culture, and let us know what you think about the companies that employ creative people. Do you think inventors get enough credit? Do you worry about too much litigation in the creative process? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our callers really quickly. We have Laura in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have just a quick story. My daughter, who was 7, had a friend along, and we had a shopo to pick up a couple of toys, and they veered towards the Barbies. And at this point now, the Barbies come in different shades of color, you know, which is nice. And when we went to the register, one of the Barbies came up differently. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, but they're on sale. And she says, oh, no, I'm sorry. It's just the minorities that are on sale, not the white ones.
Laura.
And I thought, that's what I said. I said, are you serious? I said, they're all the same, just a different tone of skin color. And she's like, yep, no, it's just a minority. Do you want it or not?
Well, Laura, thank you so much for that call. And, you know, Orlie, that brings up a really interesting point, which is for a long time, Barbie was largely seen as white, reflected a sort of white clientele base, even though a lot of people purchased it. And when Bratz entered the scene, they had different ethnicities. I believe the lead one was a Latina background. How did Bratz really challenge the market corner that Barbie had?
I really like Laura's story, and I actually tell some of these stories in the book. There is a very tenuous history of Mattel and Barbie, and not only our images of womanhood and femininity, but also race and ethnicity. And so they, as I say in the book, they take one step forward and then two steps back with all kinds of things like just giving Barbie a minority friend, or pouring a shade that's supposed to be the African American doll just into the Barbie image without altering anything, without kind of more thought of what our reality and our culture looks like. And for MGA, for Carter Bryant, first of all, and then for MGA that ended up developing Bratz, it was really important to not have that, one doll and then just with different shades, right? Like 10 different shades, and now we're nodding to having diversity. But rather, from the start, it actually put out a group of girls, and they were multi-ethnic in the sense that you said that the lead was Latina, but I think actually for Isaac Larian, the CEO of MGA, it was important that it wasn't that there was a lead, and it wasn't even clear with each girl which there were some, you know, there's some nods to there's a Latina and Asian American. He himself is an Iranian, a Persian immigrant, and he named one of the dolls after his own daughter, and I think she herself thinks that she looks like a Bratz girl, or Bratz looks a little bit like her. So, but it was sort of important that it wasn't even clear with each doll where you come from, which is more reflective of the 21st century, that it's not like, you know, we know with each person. We're all, in some sense, mixed and multi-ethnic.
But when Bratz entered the market, I want to go back a little bit of the ways, you know, how it was pretty controversial. How did the public react when they first, you know, had their commercials come on like we just heard a little while ago?
So I think it was a real success. I think MGA didn't expect to be so successful, that girls really wanted to buy Bratz, and they felt like they were more reflective of what they saw, more fashionable, more edgy, more trendy. There were, of course, also the critics. Just like there have been a lot of critics about whether Barbie is sexualized with Bratz as well, and this idea that you're selling makeup to kids, to tweens, to, you know, younger than teens, girls, you're selling them clothes that maybe are too revealing. There was a lot of that conversation of whether it's appropriate for girls.
And there has been a bit of a pushback. You see on YouTube videos of sort of making under these Bratz dolls and repainting them to look more like girls, which were the original inspiration, really, from Carter Bryant, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So Carter really wanted to have girls that, or dolls that looked like the girls that he had seen actually in the Midwest, and maybe not in L.A., where he felt that everything is more plastic and maybe kids mature faster. It's this push and pull of the toy industry, where the irony is that they are very savvy about marketing products to kids. And I describe in the book this whole philosophy of the psychology of consumption, and how Mattel very early on hired psychologists to do this kind of marketing and advertising to kids, which we had not had before, and kind of have and shape the tastes of kids. And that in turn leads to the fact that kids maybe are exposed to things that parents are not that excited about. They mature more quickly, and then they have sort of a taste and a demand for the edgier, and then there's a pushback.
Yeah, I want to delve a little bit more into that, because you come from a background in psychology. Your mother actually watched you and your friends play as part of some of her studies. What are some of the important lessons when it comes to play in, you know, this entire thing with Barbie versus Bratz?
I think that one important lesson is to have a lot of choice and not have, you know, just this one dominant image of what girls look like, what boys should play with. One of the lessons from the psychology research is that there is actually a premium for girls, or a benefit for girls that play with sort of non-traditionally gendered girl toys. So I am a mother of three girls, and as you said, I'm also the daughter of a child development psychologist. And so I've thought a lot about the toy industry, and I have to admit that not only because I am exposing the inside culture of the toy industry, but also because of how I think about the development of kids' minds and confidence and social skills. It's very important for me to kind of redirect my girls from the what we call the pink shelves of retail. You know, how you go and you enter Toys R Us or any toy store. It's really very bifurcated. You have the kids, the boys' aisles and the girls' aisles. And I think it's very important for parents to be conscious and to gently nudge both genders to reach across the aisles.
And, you know, looking back at the litigiousness of Mattel and, you know, the MGA story, what this really also comes down to is intellectual property. In the last minute that we have, what was your biggest takeaway from the legal battle between Mattel and MGA?
Intellectual property at this point has become more than we wanted it to become. So just very quickly, but there's a lot more to say. We've over-defined what copyright is, what patent is, what trade secrets are, to the detriment of the very purpose of intellectual property, which is to promote innovation and growth.
Thanks, Orly, so much.
Thank you.
Orly Lobel is a professor of law at the University of San Diego. She joined us to talk about her new book, You Don't Owe Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side, which is out today.
And you can still share your thoughts and maybe your memories of playing with either or both of these lines of dolls. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.